there are many people waiting with bated breath for these weapons of mass destruction. I think increasingly this administration is losing all credibility.
We are outraged that they lied, and doubly outraged that so few Americans seem to care.
One thing that's really important to highlight is that the government has been detaining and deporting immigrants en masse since well before September 11th.
If there were no weapons of mass destruction, we should have waited until we had UN resolution and support behind us to do it.
They can't seem to find these weapons of mass destruction that was the rationale for thousands of people dying.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, June 12, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The UN Security Council today approved another one-year exemption for American peacekeepers from prosecution by the new International War Crimes Tribunal, but it faced opposition from France, Germany, and Syria. France, Germany, and Syria abstained despite a U.S. appeal not to further strain the bitter transatlantic division over the war against Iraq. The three argued that a special U.S. exemption was not necessary and only weakens the International Criminal Court. Iraqi forces shot down a U.S. helicopter gunship in western Iraq today, just hours after U.S. fighter jets bombed what they said was a terrorist training camp in central Iraq. The incidents came as U.S. ground troops wound up a massive sweep in a Sunni Muslim enclave north of Baghdad aimed at routing out the organizers of attacks on occupation forces. Today's events marked a sharp escalation of U.S. military operations in central and western Iraq, where guerrillas have intensified attacks on U.S. troops in recent weeks. It's one of the largest operations since the war, U.S. Central Command spokesperson Lieutenant Ryan Fitzgerald said. The top U.S. civilian administrator in Iraq told lawmakers today the situation there has improved dramatically in recent weeks and blamed much of the reported looting and lawlessness on political sabotage. Paul Bremer, briefing the House of Representatives Armed Services Committee through a teleconference from Baghdad, also said he felt there were enough troops in Iraq. While he said there was an increasing number of organized attacks on U.S. troops in regions north of Baghdad, they were on a small scale of 5 to 10 people without an apparent central command and control. Bremer was speaking after an AH-64 Apache helicopter was apparently shot down by hostile fire in western Iraq. According to the U.S. Central Command, the two-member crew was not injured and was recovered, it said. In the months leading up to the U.S. war on Iraq, President Bush, Colin Powell, and others in the Bush administration continued to reassure the American people that they had proof that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction.
Our intelligence officials estimate that Saddam Hussein had the materials to produce as much as 500 tons of sarin, mustard, and VX nerve agent. In such quantities, these chemical agents could also kill untold thousands. He's not accounted for these materials. He has given no evidence that he has destroyed them.
Every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence.
We know that Saddam Hussein is determined to keep his weapons of mass destruction. He's determined to make more.
Intelligence gathered by this and other governments leaves no doubt that the Iraqi regime continues to possess and conceal some of the most lethal weapons ever devised.
Statements by President Bush and other representatives, members of the Bush cabinet regarding the existence of weapons of mass destruction. But not everyone is convinced. Congressman Dennis Kucinich introduced a resolution of inquiry in Congress yesterday calling for Bush to turn over the intelligence used to back up its claims that it had weapons of mass destruction and posed an imminent threat to the U.S. Several weeks after the U.S. forces overthrew the Saddam Hussein regime, U.S. forces have been unable to find any evidence of this purported arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. After searching more than 300 sites, the U.S. forces have been unsuccessful in locating any of the massive stockpiles of chemical or biological weapons. Peace Watch spoke with U.S. Congresswoman Maxine Waters, a Democrat from California, regarding the search for weapons of mass destruction and asked whether it really mattered that we could not find them.
there are many people waiting with bated breath for these weapons of mass destruction. I think increasingly this administration is losing all credibility. We tried so very hard to get him to agree to continue the inspections prior to his preemptive strike. If he had continued those inspections, perhaps he would have discovered just what he's discovering now, that there are no weapons of mass destruction. He's attempting now to make the case that at one time they had them or they had the capability of developing them. As I listen closely to his speech, it seems as if he's modifying the accusation. But no matter how he puts it, he lacks credibility because he has used massive resources from this country for this preemptive strike. Aside from the billions of dollars that have been spent and the billions that we'll have to continue to spend, American soldiers lost their lives and continue to lose their lives every day.
Mm-hmm.
So this president has, placed us in a position of, again, expending huge amounts of resources and putting us at risk and our soldiers and our children at risk. And I think that he is going to have to account to the American people eventually for this. The American people put their trust in him. And I think a lot of people went along with the war, even though they weren't quite sure. They gave the president the benefit of the doubt. And they certainly felt, given that we had had the terrorist strike of 9/11, that this president must know what he's talking about. He must have the information. We have some of the most sophisticated surveillance equipment and techniques and procedures. A CIA who's paid to do nothing but protect this country with offshore interaction and surveillance. Why doesn't he have the right information?
Mm-hmm.
How did this get so messed up? In one instance, it looks as if there was an outright lie. I watched last night the clip that they played of the president in his State of the Union speech, where they talked about them getting materials from Africa, making this so-called nuclear bomb and weapons of mass destruction, only to find out it was a lie. I think the administration said the CIA said it. The CIA said they did not say it. Then somebody said they heard the British said it,
mm-hmm.
but they had no documentation that this is true.
Well, now, in fact, some of the intelligence communities here in the U.S. and in Britain as well have actually said that they were pressured to skew the intelligence in order to fit the administration's position with regard to Iraq, that it was, in fact, an imminent threat. Based on these allegations,
I do know that there have been requests for hearings. And I hear that some of the response is that the administration doesn't want a formalized hearing, that there's so much classified information that if there's a formalized hearing, this classified information could be leaked or put out there in ways that would be harmful. But, that's one way that oftentimes,
mm-hmm.
Agencies will hide behind classified information, particularly the intelligence community.
So you're saying you're going to use the cloak of national security as a threat to...
Right. That happens too often.
Also, we've heard the GOP just basically downplaying the whole situation, saying that this is just a bunch of Democrats who are using this to further their own political ends.
Well, of course they would, because they were jumping up and down urging this president to go to war, and they were in agreement with him that he should have this preemptive strike. They supported him, and of course, if there are no weapons of mass destruction, their credibility is also weakened and undermined by their lack of documentation and information and inability to find these weapons. So I'm sure they don't want this to be the case and that this is discovered by the American people. So, they might have been in their head that they had weapons of mass destruction, and they were sure that if they invaded the country, they would find them. Maybe that's what they thought. But the fact of the matter is, as of today, they have not found them.
Articles have suggested, too, in the Christian Science Monitor come to mind, that Democrats should perhaps tread softly, because if eventually weapons of mass destruction are found, then they could look pretty silly for making such a fuss over the fact that they are.
I think that our position should certainly be that to date, they have not found weapons of mass destruction, that when the preemptive strike was taken, we should have known where they were. We should have identified them. We should have seen them. We should have known that they had them. Now, the fact of the matter is, when they made the preemptive strike, they did not know that there were weapons of mass destruction. That much is true at this point.
Mm-hmm.
They may find some later on, who's to say? But still, that does not negate the fact that when they made the strike, they didn't know that there were any weapons of mass destruction, because they don't have any pictures of them, they can't identify them, they don't have the information as of today.
Representative Dennis Kucinich, the leader of the opposition to the war in Iraq in the House, took to the House floor yesterday to continue to press for a demand that the truth of the administration's lead up to the war, that they provide evidence and that there be some investigation. And he spoke of the vast stockpiles that the administration said were an imminent threat. And at the State of the Union address, the president actually said President Saddam Hussein had the materials to produce as much as 500 tons of sarin, mustard, and VX nerve agent. And I'm wondering if you can tell us what the status is of that push in the House. Where does that resolution stand right now?
Well, this is going to take some time. Unfortunately, you know, you don't move this body overnight, and the American public takes a while to catch up with the information, but I'm convinced that this issue will not go away, that we're going to have to take it up, that there must be some hearings on it, and the more the people are made to understand that perhaps they have been misled, perhaps they have been lied to, the more the people will demand to know the truth and hold this president responsible for it. So this is just the beginning in calling for this administration to have to appear to answer the questions about what did they know, when did they know it, why didn't they know it, and why did they say they knew it.
Mm-hmm. Is this just really just a matter of possibly lying, or is it an issue of credibility, or is there some potential criminal activity or liability here?
I don't know that there's any criminal liability or activity. After all, the President of the United States has the authority and the ability to do certain things, but there certainly is a great credibility issue here. The President of the United States led this country into war with Iraq based on information that he said he had. And so far, he's not been able to produce the information. So we know for sure he didn't have the information when he made the strike, and he should have to account for that, even if they find something. For me, that will not answer the question of why didn't you know it when you made the strike. Where's all this money we spend on the CIA? Where is your intelligence community? Now, we did know somewhere during the time that we were having the discussion about the inspections, continuing the inspections, the CIA is not just saying that they were pressured. They said that some time ago, that there was some attempts to get them to say what the administration needed them to say, and they resisted that back months ago.
Congresswoman Maxine Waters, a Democrat from California. Outrage at administration lying misses a crucial point. So says Professor Iris Chernus of the University of Colorado at Boulder in this next commentary.
Wow. The government knew all along there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And they used that as an excuse to take us to war anyway. My generation, raised on the film Casablanca, would say, I'm shocked, shocked, George W., to discover lying going on in your administration. A younger generation would say, well, duh. I mean, what did anyone expect? The government that would tell us the truth? The truth, revealed so unexpectedly in the mainstream press, also reveals a profound dilemma for the left. We run around excitedly exclaiming, we told you so. Then we expect to see the Bush war machine at least crippled, if not brought down entirely. When the Bushies seem to sail along virtually unscathed, we don't get it. We are outraged that they lied, and doubly outraged that so few Americans seem to care. In our perplexed outrage, we are missing a crucial point. While we quite rightly care about the facts, we also need to consider the peculiar fate of facts in this postmodern world. While we quite rightly drink in the words of a Noam Chomsky or a Howard Zinn, we would do well to give equal time to a Frederick Jameson, the Duke University professor who is the left's most perceptive critic of postmodernism. Jameson taught us better than anyone else that the American empire rests on three legs: global corporate capitalism, digital technology, and the triumph of image over factual reality. He taught us why the empire needs each of these legs to stay stable and how each reinforces the others in a totalitarian web. Most of us already understand the power of digitized high tech and globalization and the links between them. The crucial piece many have missed is the third leg. In postmodern capitalism, commodities are reduced to digital images, and images are sold as commodities. The images take on a life of their own. They become the reality. Reality is now just an endless commercial. Advertising is no longer just a means to an end. It is the essential activity of our whole society. That's a simple truth we all know because most of us live it every day. I surely do. I think The Matrix and the new Honda ad and my new screensaver are pretty cool, too. Intellectuals like Jameson help us take the next step to understand what happens when images replace reality. Our society stops asking the questions that used to point the way to truth. Questions like, does the image accurately represent the reality it claims to represent? Does it represent any reality at all? When those questions are no longer asked, the issue of truth becomes irrelevant. Then it's easy enough to declare the elected leader of a whole nation, or even the entire United Nations, irrelevant. Because the words are just images anyway. All questions of truth and reality simply vanish in the airwaves filled with the digitized pictures and sounds that are now the be-all and end-all of our collective life. So the Bush administration's warnings of Iraqi WMD were merely images. An ad campaign clever enough to sell us a war we did not need. But no one ever bought the reality because there was no reality to buy. The public bought the commercials. In a postmodern society, that's all we ever buy because images are all that's for sale. Our outrage at the Bush administration's lies is an attack upon a symptom. Symptomatic relief is always welcome, but it doesn't make sense to deal with symptoms and ignore the underlying disease. If you want to cure the disease, you first have to understand it. We must go on unmasking lies and presenting factual truth. It will make some difference, but it won't make enough difference unless at the same time we try to rescue the very idea of truth itself before it disappears forever into that kaleidoscope of digitized images. A good place to start is by understanding Frederick Jameson's analysis. You can read more about it at www.colorado.edu/religious studies. That's colorado.edu/religious studies, capital R, capital S.
Professor Ira Chernus of the Religious Studies Department at the University of Colorado at Boulder.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we gotta find a way to bring some love. Father, Father, we don't need to ask your name. War is not the answer, 'cause only love comes to me. You know we gotta find a way to bring some love.
18-year-old Haitian who became the center of a letter-writing campaign by Amnesty International has been released from a West Miami-Dade County detention center nearly 5 months after an immigration judge granted him asylum. Ernesto Joseph, who arrived in South Florida on October 29th as part of a boatload of more than 200 Haitian asylum seekers, was paroled yesterday from the Chrome Detention Center. Immigration officials cited humanitarian grounds as the reason for his parole. Whether Joseph, a soft-spoken young man who looks much younger than his recorded age, gets to remain in the United States will depend on the Board of Immigration Appeals. The Department of Homeland Security, which continued to detain Joseph despite the judge's ruling, has appealed the asylum decision. Arthi Shohani of Families for Freedom speaks on the Bush administration's attack on immigrants and the growing division between citizens and non-citizens in the U.S. Shohani expresses that the detention and deportation laws are being manipulated by law enforcement agencies targeting and infringing on the rights of a growing number of immigrants as part of the new National Homeland Security Act and the war on terrorism.
In Families for Freedom, basically everyone is facing immigrant detention and deportation. Either they have family members that are in county jails right now being incarcerated by the government and about to be processed out, or they're people that have loved ones that have already been deported, et cetera, et cetera. So a few points that we think it's really important to highlight is detention and deportation, I think, have really hit the public scene and become really key issues after September 11th. People associate it with national security. People associate it now with, you know, what is best for our communities, our safety, the war on terror, so to speak. But one thing that's really important to highlight is that the government has been detaining and deporting immigrants en masse since well before September 11th. A key document to look at, or two key laws to look at, are laws passed in 1996. One on the first year anniversary of Timothy McVeigh bombing the federal building. In April 1996, Congress passed the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. That law completely changed detention and deportation, and it did a few things. One, it expanded the grounds of deportation. So all sorts of immigrants that couldn't be kicked out of the U.S. could now be kicked out of the U.S. for different types of reasons. On top of that, they made deportation proceedings mandatory. So you can't seek any type of relief at all. You can't go before a judge. You can't say, I have 10 U.S. citizen children, a dog here, a job here, any of that stuff. None of it matters. Who you are doesn't matter. You're going to be kicked out because by law you have no relief. On top of that, when you're going through deportation proceedings, you're going to be incarcerated under what's called mandatory detention. What that means is that deportation proceedings are a trial, right? It's a process in which the government has to determine whether or not you can be kicked out of the U.S. But under the 1996 laws, you can be held incarcerated without any chance of bond at all. So it's basically this sort of guilty until proven innocent type situation where your physical body is being held, your most basic human constitutional right is taken away from you, all because you're an immigrant now in this situation. So one thing that we think is really important to point out is that the infrastructure, the legal infrastructure for all of the detentions and deportations was well in place before September 11th. On top of that, the government was pouring millions and millions of dollars into the system, also since well before the war on terror. So for example, in 1994, you had the government incarcerating about 4,000 or 6,000 immigrants daily in the immigrant prison system. After the passage of the 96 laws, by the year 2000, that number exploded to over 20,000, making immigrants the fastest growing segment of the prison population in the U.S. So all of that had already been well in place. What's happening now? What's been changing? You've been seeing, for example, targeting of specific communities. The vast majority of people getting deported right now are Latino Caribbean folks. That's the vast majority of people. But you have people from all countries. It's a real United Nations inside detention centers. You have people from all countries inside. A growing segment now are people from Arab, Muslim, South Asian backgrounds. And the way that the government is targeting people is really terrifying because you're seeing now collaboration among different agencies. So, for example, you have the federal government working with local law enforcement to go to people's communities, to go to their homes, to go to their workplaces, to take them from their families and throw them into these deportation proceedings. So the collaboration has really accelerated and intensified since September 11th, more and more and more. So, for example, in New York, where I'm from, Mayor Bloomberg just decided to pass a city ordinance allowing explicitly NYPD to hand people, or public servants in general, to hand immigrants over to immigration deportation if for some reason they're found to be deportable. Previously, that wasn't allowed. There were executive orders issued actually barring that stuff because they worried about immigrant safety. Like, what immigrant's going to go to a public servant if you're afraid that that's going to land you, you know, out of the country? So that's the sort of situation you're seeing now. You're seeing more collaboration among these different agencies, but there aren't any criminal protections or due process protections afforded to people. So it's like, it's a real sham what goes on in terms of deportation, because people are thrown into the system. Because it's technically an administrative proceeding, you don't have the right to counsel. So up to 80-90% of the people facing deportation have no attorney whatsoever. You're talking about a punishment far more severe than prison time. You're talking about exile from the United States, possibly for life. You have no attorney whatsoever. When you're put into detention, the incarceration is indefinite. You don't know when you're going to get out. There's no set date on it. It's basically you're in there for as long as it takes for deportation to happen. You're in there until you break down and you say, okay, get me out of here, basically. That's what happens. On top of that, when you're put into detention, you can be transferred from one part in the country to another part in the country without any notice. So we constantly have constituency, for example, that are from Queens, that have been living in Queens 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and are now being sent down to Louisiana because it's cheaper to house people there. So that's what an immigrant goes through. What does their family go through? Their family goes through completely losing that person from their lives. Oftentimes, the person being detained is the sole breadwinner of the family. So you have, you know, quintessentially, the wife and her children that are now at home, not able to pay rent, in debt, you know, months and months and months, about to get the eviction notice, not able to keep themselves together, the kids having no idea where dad may or may not be, because maybe the wife didn't want to tell them, oh, he's actually, you know, being incarcerated right now, that sort of devastating situation. The detainee is not really able to have contact with the family even via phone, because it's usually marked up collect calls only, $5 the first minute, $1 each additional minute. This is sort of all the stuff that goes on. So, you know, what I think is really, really interesting is when we talk about detention deportation, you see Attorney General Ashcroft, you know, on, you know, whatever, CNN, talking about the apprehension of possible terrorists, suspected terrorists, criminal aliens, et cetera, et cetera. And if you get away from all these abstract and charged terms, what you're looking at is immigrant families that are largely working class that may be deportable because the laws have expanded to such a great extent to make immigrants deportable for so many things. But you're basically talking about the destruction of families going on left and right. Having said all that, I think that one reason that it's so important to look at immigrant detention and deportation in the context of our communities, our safety, what it means for sort of all people in the United States, what it means for the anti-war movement, is that the government has found an extremely useful tool. I mean, everyone has sort of noted that, especially since September 11th, the executive branch is usurping power. Balance of powers is out the window. It's all about like a recluse sort of AG, Attorney General, and Bush sort of doing their own thing. They have seized upon immigrants as a key way to do that, because immigrants are feeding the national frenzy. People are afraid of the idea of the immigrant, and there's a sort of, you know, sort of psychological economy going on where people feel like there's just a limited number of rights and not everyone needs to have it, so let's get rid of the rights of immigrants. So more and more and more, and I'm, you know, I start the story with 1996 and it goes on and it builds through September 11. What you're seeing is non-citizens in the United States are really losing their rights. You're losing your rights because deportations are growing, because you're subject to this punishment more and more. You're losing your labor rights. You're afraid to organize because you're afraid it'll land you somehow in trouble and then deported. You're losing your public benefits. You're losing all this stuff. So the divide between citizen and non-citizen is growing sort of legally, socially, economically, to such a great extent that what we're really seeing happen in the U.S. is the formation of some sort of apartheid state. You know, it's citizen versus non-citizen. That's a deep legal divide. And so I think that as we continue to work, as we talk about the anti-war movement, as we talk about our own rights, you know, racial justice work, et cetera, it's really important to keep in mind how immigrants' rights are a key site in this sort of battle.
Arthi Shohani, an organizer of Families for Freedom, a New York area network of immigrants facing detention and deportation, consisting of primarily Latino and South Asians that live in the New York and New Jersey area. Thanks to Evan Davis for production assistance with that speech. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, social critic Jim Hightower stops by our Peace Watch studios.
The very first responsibility of democracy is to fight for the very freedoms that they're now taking from us in the name of preserving freedom.
We'll be back in a moment.